Welcome to Indie Piece, an in-depth look at the independently developed video games that we call masterpieces. Presented by OK Beast, I'm your host, Blessing Adeoye. Yo, what's up? Welcome to Indie Piece. Indie Piece is a podcast series dedicated towards celebrating the independently created video games that we hail as masterpieces of the medium. Every episode, we take a look at a different indie game, deconstruct it, and analyze what makes it a work of art and stand out among the rest. On this podcast, we'll be taking a look at indie side-scrollers, walking sims, physics games, and games that have broken the mold of the medium. Season 1, we've taken a look at games such as Undertale, Gone Home, and Cuphead. We've got a few more games to go, including The Witness, which we'll be talking about next episode, and our season finale, which will be the episode after. So we're almost there, guys. Three more episodes left, including this one. This episode, we're discussing...
I'm not turning back. It took months to get here. Well, maybe, but I made my promise.
Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice. I'm your host, Blessing Adeoye. Joining me, we have Jessica Cogswell, an editor for Irrational Passions. Jessica, how's it going?
It's going. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Are you excited to talk about Hellblade?
I am so excited to talk about Hellblade. This was actually my 2017 game of the year, so
really?
I'm pumped. Yeah,
really
I love
good,
this game.
Really good choice. I think it was in my top five, if I remember my list correctly. Really good game. Also joining us, we have Alex O'Neill, the editor-in-chief of Irrational Passions. Alex, how's it going?
It's good. I'm here to be. You can't podcast without an Alex present, and I'm here to
exactly.
fill the void.
I mean, that's pretty much the curse of OK Beast, is that an Alex always has to be on every episode and every podcast.
Yep.
Are you excited to talk about Hellblade?
I am so excited. It's been a while since I played it, but it was my number three from 2017. I actually just played the first 2 hours before we started recording again, just to refresh myself, and that game is something else.
Nice. So let's talk about it. Guys, coming into this episode, what are your feelings and your story of Hellblade's newest sacrifice coming in? Alex, I'm going to start with you.
Hellblade was a game that I feel like was in development for, it felt like a long time. I think it was only really like 3 or 4 years, but I remember after DMC Devil May Cry came out, that was my point to getting really into Ninja Theory, and seeing Hellblade and what it kind of turned into from being this cool, empowering, like female driven action game, to something a lot more intimate, to something a lot more personal, and a much more unique story. Like, I don't think there's another story like Hellblade in games, right? They took these two super different concepts, but also like super opposed concepts of like mental health and this 8th century mythology,
yeah,
and putting them together in such a really, really cool way. I think it's a really incredible game, and I don't think there's ever been anything like it since.
Do you remember going in to the release of Hellblade, like what people's thoughts were on what the game was going to be? Because I remember the game coming out and immediately people were like, oh wow, this game is different from like what the perspective or the expectation was.
I think
that makes sense.
It helps that my co-host Nabishin and I like were still trying to keep up with Hellblade, and they were doing like developer diaries leading up to release. He was watching those, I was not, because I was trying to not know too much about the game going into it, and I ended up buying it the day of release and not playing it for like 4 months after, or 2 months or 3 months after, just because like it got lost in a sea of other video games in 2017. But I remember when I went and actually played it, it certainly surprised me a lot, but I did know a little bit about like this aspect of dementia or schizophrenia, like being a part of that game and a part of that character. I was just like ready for it to just wash over me, and I think it did a really great job at doing that.
Nice. Jessica, what about you? What are your surface level feelings on Hellblade?
Okay, so Hellblade to me, I think what drew me in was the aesthetic of it all, really. There are so many games that kind of tap into like Greek or Roman mythology, but you don't really see Norse used a whole lot. And I know like we've kind of seen a resurgence of that lately.
Yeah.
Within
the last like couple years specifically, like between like God of War, Hellblade, and then like Thor Ragnarok, and I guess all the Thor movies, but Ragnarok I think was the one that like really got people into it, like the idea of Ragnarok specifically and a lot of the mythology there.
And even like Neil Gaiman, Gaiman, like he just a couple years ago, wrote a book on Norse mythology, which is just like a modern retelling of a lot of the different myths. And so that to me drew me in initially, and it just looked beautiful too. And I mean, it still does. For like how small of a studio worked on it, it's kind of incredible how that game looks. So that drew me in. You know, female protagonist as a woman always kind of initially draws me in. It's always nice to see that, always refreshing. And then also it's interesting because it did tackle mental health, and that's something that can be really tricky. And so that was something that I kind of wanted to see how they did it, because sometimes like mental health issues can almost be like fetishized in games. And like that's something that you never – it's not good when you're somebody who does suffer from, you know, a personality disorder or a mental – you know, to see that in games. So that was something that I kind of wanted to see how they did that. And on top of that, to me, at its core, Hellblade is kind of, and I won't go into this too much now because we're going to talk about it later, but it's a love story. And generally with games, when you think of a game being like a romance game, you think, oh, it's going to be like something like a mobile game type thing like Florence, where it's just like a visual novel, or it's going to be something like a dating sim type thing, you know what I mean? Or some sort of simulation game. But I mean, the whole story is essentially it revolves around love. And for that to be the core of the story, but for it to be like an action game, is really interesting and kind of weird, and I love it.
No, it's really good, and we'll get into it in a bit. Let's get into some game facts, though. So Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice was developed by Ninja Theory. Who is Ninja Theory? Ninja Theory was founded in 2000 as Just Add Monsters Limited. Ninja Theory Limited is a British video game development studio based in Cambridge, England. Notable games they have developed include Heavenly Sword, Enslaved, Odyssey to the West, DMC, Devil May Cry, and Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice. I don't think I've played any of those games aside from DMC, like the first few hours of DMC and Hellblade. I don't know if you guys have played Heavenly Sword or Enslaved, Odyssey to the West. I know they're fairly, I mean, I don't know, fairly popular, but I know they're known at least.
Yeah, I think Enslaved is very rad. I think you would really like Enslaved. It's very rough around the edges, which is why I think it doesn't hold the same kind of like notability as some of these other games that they've done, but it's a really cool, it's, you know, it's based on the Odyssey to the West story that like Goku is from in Dragon Ball. So Monkey, the main character of that game, is kind of like a reimagining of that same character.
Interesting. That's a PS3 game, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's one of those games that I would see at GameStop whenever I went there.
I think
like,
it was like put on PS4 and Xbox One. I don't know if I'm right.
Interesting.
About that.
I might look into that. So Ninja Theory, they were acquired by Argonaut Games soon after its founding and released Kung Fu Chaos for the original Xbox. The company purchased itself from administrators after Argonaut Games was liquidated but suffered from financial troubles. Sony Computer Entertainment saved the team from bankruptcy by funding the development of Heavenly Sword. The team then moved on to develop Enslaved, Odyssey to the West, and DMC Devil May Cry, separate from Sony. Ninja Theory began diversifying its portfolio of games and taking on contract work for publishers after finishing the development of DMC. They also entrusted a small team to develop their first self-published title, Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice, which we're talking about on this episode. So let's get into some plot and setup. So, set in the late 8th century, the game starts with Senua, a picked warrior from Orkney, arriving at the border of Helheim in a quest to save the soul of her dead lover, Dillion, from the goddess Hela. Also, before I even go further, I want to give a shout-out to Wikipedia, because Wikipedia has been saving this podcast. Because usually where we get these plots and setups for all these episodes is from Wikipedia, and I'll go in and I'll change what needs to be changed. And this game being very heavy and deep in terms of like story and narrative and stuff that's going on, especially behind the scenes with like all the mythology and stuff, Wikipedia was a lifesaver, and so shout out to Wikipedia. Senua believes that she suffers from a curse and hears furies, voices in her head commenting her every action, notably one, the narrator, who is aware of the player's presence and talks directly to them. She is also followed by the darkness, a dark entity at the core of the curse. She carries Dillion's severed head to use it as a vessel to a soul, and is also guided by her memories of the stories of Druth, a former slave of the Norsemen, well-versed in their legends, now deceased, who became her friend and mentor during a year-long self-imposed exile. To enter Helheim, Snua defeats both the fire giant Surt and the spirit of illusions, Valraven. I believe I got that right, Valraven. But as she crosses the bridge to Helheim, is attacked by Hela, who defeats her with a single blow, shattering her sword. Barely surviving the encounter, she follows visions of Druth and a man-shaped light she believes to be Dillion to a giant tree, where she faces four challenges linked to her past, and is rewarded with the legendary sword Grammar, strong enough to kill gods. So the first question I'm gonna throw you guys, Hellblade's new sacrifice straight up just like lies to you at the beginning of the game, suggests that if you repeatedly fail, that your save will be wiped. Like, I think the exact language it uses is that your progress will be lost. How do you guys feel about that decision and how that kind of contributes to the story of Hellblade? Because I feel like the day of release of this game, it was very controversial. Like, news stories were all about, like, is this mechanic real? Like, do you really lose your save? Like, how does that affect the game? Jess, I'm going to go to you first. What do you think of that decision for them to straight up just, like, kind of lie to you or play with your expectations of what's going to happen in the game?
I think it was incredibly clever. And I think that it kind of makes it makes the core concept of the game, as far as, like, mental illness and like having all of these things told to you that aren't necessarily true, and having to kind of like it reinforces that, and it drags you into, not only is Senua the person who's now who has this information being fed to her that's not correct, like now you have that, and it kind of connects you to her. So I thought it was clever. I thought it was cool. It kind of adds a little bit more stress to the game, and I think that there's I like when my games have a good amount of stress to them.
Yeah. No, I agree, too, because, like, this game is not necessarily Dark Souls, where, like, the combat is super difficult. Like, it can get hard at times, but you still have kind of, like, that Dark Souls-esque, like, stress to it, because you think, like, at any moment, if I mess up or I make the wrong move, that it's all going to be over for me. And I think having that level of stress, like, kind of as you said, right, like, having that level of stress or, like, that misguidance kind of plays into the character of Senua and kind of what she's going through, and so you kind of relate to her in that way. Alex, what do you think?
I thought it was brilliant as well. I like a thing that I think movies and TV shows have gotten more comfortable doing, probably too comfortable doing, is like lying to the audience. But it's a thing that I think video games very rarely do, and I don't necessarily mean to completely compare the two, but I think subverting the expectation, like, video games have this history of never really lying to the player about mechanics, right? That's like the level that is pure, right? You need to know these things in order to progress through the game. But totally just straight up lying about that, I think, is really clever and really, I think it sets the tone and it adds a lot of stakes to everything. It makes you really think about what you're doing as you're doing it. It creates this tension in you through Senua as well. And also, like, re-seeing that scene, it is illustrated that, like, one of the voices, the kind of main narrator voices that we're going to talk about a little bit later, is the one that infers that information from what happens to Senua and the darkness that starts crawling up her hand. And she's the one that says that. It's never really, like, there's no other further power.
Yeah,
that is saying that. So if kind of like what you were saying, Jess, the inference of kind of her, what she believes is getting regurgitated back at her in a way that's so convincing that even you buy it, I think it's just really kind of helping you connect to Senua and really putting you in her position. Like, you can't trust anything either. I think that's so cool.
Well, and it's like one of the, like, the hallmarks, I guess, of a lot of different mental illnesses is like that kind of cognitive dissonance. And that establishes that in you, and it gives you a little bit of a taste of that, because it's like it's so easy for someone who, and it's so easy for all humans, but, you know, for anybody who suffers anxiety, depression, bipolar, whatever, it's so easy to jump to the worst conclusions, or to have kind of like that fatal thought, or like when one thing happens, it's not just like, oh, this, it's, you know, it, what's funny is I actually had a friend just give me this example. It's not I'm 5 minutes late to work. It's I'm 5 minutes late to work. Everybody at my work hates me. I'm a bad person. I'm going to get fired. I'm never going to get a job again. You know what I mean? Like that's like the line of thought that you would go down if you have that kind of thinking. And so it's kind of a, an interesting thing for it to go to the worst possible thing, like, oh, you will lose your game save data if you do this. If you mess up, if you make the wrong call, if you die too much, if you're not good enough for this, like, this is what's going to happen to you. So, like, to throw that in there and kind of, like, throw off the person playing, I think it's really smart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, like, to allude to the thesis I'm going to talk about later, it's not just establishing empathy with the player, but it's forcing it upon the player. Like, you are... You're being thrown into this position where you kind of have to, you have to really understand where Senua is coming from and the things that she's going through and how real the furies, the voices to her are. And, you know, sometimes that reality is the only thing that matters.
Yeah. So to continue with the plot, Senua's backstory is unveiled through her hallucinations, revealing that her mother, Galena, suffered the same curse that she did not believe it to be dreadful. However, Senua's devoutly religious father, Zinbel, I'm going to say Zinbel because it sounds close to Zatchbel. Her religious father, Zinbel, did, and burned Galena alive. Senua witnessed the event at age 5, which caused her psychosis to worsen significantly and led her to convince herself her mother died willingly. Her father convincing her that her condition was a curse abused Senua emotionally and physically and isolated her from the rest of the world until she met Dillion when he visited her village. The two fell in love and Senua left her father to be with him as he saw her as different and misunderstood instead of cursed. However, after a plague killed many in Dillion's village, Senua, believing the fault to be hers, left in exile. When she returned a year later, having hopefully left the darkness behind, she found everyone killed by Norsemen who had invaded, sacrificing Dillion in a blood eagle to their gods. Remembering the stories of Druth, Senua departed on her journey to save Dillion's soul from the gods of the Norsemen. Ultimately, Senua fights against the influence of the darkness and defeats the beast Garm. She then realizes the darkness is a representation of her father's abuse and beliefs and frees herself from the Furies. Soon after, she faces a legion of Hela's warriors in a hopeless fight and is killed. In her final moments, she recalls Dillion telling her of the importance of the acceptance of loss. As the imagery of Helheim fades away, Hela drops Dillion's head into the abyss, but as the camera returns to her, Senua is standing in her place with a dead Hela in place of Senua's body. Having accepted that it was never possible to bring her lover back and that she is not responsible for his death or anyone else's, Senua frees herself from the darkness's influence and accepts the Furies not as a curse, but a part of who she is. She invites the player to follow her while the narrator says her goodbyes to the player. So does Hellblade's narrative succeed in balancing in its balancing act of telling a story rooted in Norse mythology while also being as much about the struggles and stigma of mental health? Alex, I'm going to throw this one to you first. What do you think?
I think so. And I think like that's what when we're going to kind of talk about the indie factor later and what makes this feel more independent than, say, like a AAA, like a God of War, which came out like, you know, 10 months later that tackled a lot of the same mythos. Hellblade is grounding everything that it wants to talk about, like psychosis and mental health, and it's in trauma especially, and self-empowerment and kind of overcoming these things. It's grounding all that in a time that maybe we're not super familiar with, but contextually when you put someone like this in that time, they make it work, they make it make sense, they tie it all together. Like her, this kind of mythos she's built around herself of like these voices in my head are the Furies and they're a curse, and this darkness that haunts me, this trauma that haunts me, is something supernatural. It's something beyond my understanding. Like everything makes sense. Everything's tied together. And it makes everything more impactful because by the end of the story, even as ridiculous and over the top and kind of the fantasy that you really get to see through Senua's eyes, you really believe that there was like a true internal triumph. And I like that at the very end, it kind of draws it into question. how much of what you saw was real, and how much of it was just kind of inside of your head. And I like that. I like that they're both like this, the fantasy of the game and the truth, this horrible mental health problem that you're kind of grappling with, and learning to understand and learning to accept, they're both equally as real.
Yeah. Between this game and God of War, and Thor, and like basically a lot of like fiction that's coming out, or that has come out recently, I really need to check out that Neil Gaiman book on Norse mythology.
It's fantastic. You absolutely should.
Because like this game is probably like the tipping point of me starting to kind of fall in love with what the going ons in Norse mythology. I think Thor might have like got me like acquainted with like who these people are and in a few different ideas, but this game, between like the encounters with Hela and a lot of the abstract stuff that's going on, like not knowing too much about Norse mythology and playing this game, I feel like I could relate to the feeling of kind of being lost that you can kind of tell that Senua is experiencing, between her psychosis and between like her journey into this unknown place. Like, as a player, I feel like I'm there with her, and I feel like this is almost like it's this unexpected perfect setting for this kind of story, because the struggle kind of goes hand in hand, like the struggle of like going into hell to bring back Dillion kind of goes hand in hand with Dillion's like mental struggle, like, because I don't know, because it just feels like this amorphous kind of place, this amorphous journey that seems hopeless, and at the end of the day, it kind of appears to be hopeless in some ways, at least with like the literal journey of going to hell, right? Like, I think she comes to terms with her mental health, but I don't know, it's just super interesting and done in a way that I didn't realize could be done before playing this game.
You will die.
We'll all die someday.
Certainly.
I'll continue tomorrow.
You're afraid of the dark.
I'm being patient.
Getting closer to
him. I hope so.
So I think that it balances the two very well. It never seems like the game is overpowered, I guess, by the mythology that it's also talking about. And I think that the way that you can collect runes and that kind of gives you a little bit more insight if that's what you're looking for is good. So I think that that's a good mechanism there. Mm-hmm. And I would say that I think it does a really good job of making the story almost more universal by making it in such like a niche setting, because it's like you don't really think, and this is like when I first started college, I was a history major. I've always been really, really, really interested in history, and it's a passion of mine. And so I think that a lot of times when people study history, they don't necessarily, you think a lot about like dates and people, but you don't necessarily think about like the humanity in them and how like mental illness is something that's always existed. And this, even back in the 8th century, is going into that, and it's going into how these people were treated and how these people lived. And it also kind of makes something else universal, and that's the power of storytelling. Because, I mean, think about, especially as people who do podcasts, who talk about games and movies or music or whatever we talk, you know, how much media means to us. And it's like the stories of the time were the myths about gods and legends and heroes. Mm-hmm. And she copes entirely with loss and with acceptance and grieving and her mental illness through stories that she's heard. And so I think that's kind of powerful, too. I think that this game does a really good job of going into something very niche, but through that, making something universal and telling a really interesting story in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The nuance of Hellblade is like the moments where it's just like so real, so grounded, you know, like storytelling and coping and kind of the human to human connections. And like one thing that I was going to bring up later too, another kind of like universal that this game brings in is like how a positive person in your life can literally change everything about your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All it takes is like one person to make you realize like maybe I don't deserve how I treat myself and how others treat me. Like maybe I'm worth more than that and I can be loved.
Yeah. It's really poignant the way it's presented too.
Let's get into some of the setup. So Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice is divided into two types of gameplay. The first allows Senua to walk freely and interact with her surroundings. Those parts focus on either story via voiceover as Senua travels from one location to another, or the resolution of a puzzle or challenge of some kind to progress further. She can use a capacity known as focus in reference to her tendency to see things differently from other people due to her condition to trigger puzzle-related events. If she uses her focus on totems hidden throughout the game, it triggers a memory via voiceover of her friend, Druth, telling her stories of the Norsemen, which we were just talking about. In addition, Hellblade features fights against malformed representations of Norsemen who block her progression, including occasional bosses. During those fights, Senua has her sword drawn out and is turned towards one of her enemies, on which the camera is automatically focused. She can use two kinds of attacks, quick or heavy, kick an enemy to prevent it from blocking her attacks, parry or dodge. Hellblade does not feature any HUD or tutorials. Instead, Druth, Furies, or the Darkness provide audio indications on game mechanics and how to progress through levels and puzzles. The Furies also provides Senua advice in battle, notably warning her if an enemy is attacking from her back. They react when Senua takes damage and panic heavily if she is close to death. How nervous they are when she takes a hit is representative of how much damage she can still take. So throughout the game, you hear voices as Senua. That's like a huge part of it. As you're playing, like from beginning to end, voices are speaking through like both sides of your headphones. It's actually really cool. The game employs binaural audio to simulate the experience of psychosis and put us in Senua's shoes. What does this bring to the game, and is this successful? Jessica, I'm going to throw this one to you first.
This brings everything to the game and is incredibly successful. It is actually like one of... just like a triumph of this game, really. Yeah. In a game, like, I love this game so much. So, like, in many ways, I think this game is triumphant. But, like the sound design is so good. I actually, on Twitter, reached out. I think that he liked one of my tweets or something about Hellblade when I was playing it. Mm-hmm. And it was the guy who did the sound design. And, like, I saw that and I was like, oh, my God. And so I, like, DM'd him. And I was like, hey, just so you know, you did an incredible job. Just because, like, it's so good.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm somebody who, like... and I'm gonna be like a huge nerd here and say that like I'm one of those people who like likes ASMR and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they use the I can never even pronounce it, the binaural.
Binaural.
Okay, thank you.
It's a weird word. I didn't know this word existed until this game.
Okay, yeah, and it's like it's one of those ones that I trip over, but that's the type of recording that they use when they do it that way. You have like the, you know,
oh,
depending,
yeah,
upon
like
where your position on the microphone, yeah, is where you hear it. And it's really cool. I'm very sensitive to sounds. So like for me, it really draws me in, and it makes it kind of creepy and kind of tense. It feels like you're there. If like the voices that you're hearing all around you, like that it's immersive.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that it does it extremely well, and it brings a lot of the mood and atmosphere to the game.
Yeah, Hellblade was a very easy winner for OKBeast's best audio visual design category in our game of the year in 2017. Like, I mean, one, the game looks great. Like we talked about that earlier, and I'm still shocked that a team being as small as they are able to pull off a game that looks as incredible as it does, especially like what they do with characters and like the character Senua, like the expressions that she makes, like that stuff looks incredible. But yeah, like the audio stuff is really what takes it to the next level, because it's one of those things, right, where like the whole idea of binaural audio is that like you're supposed to kind of get the experience of hearing voices or hearing sound like all around you, right, left, right, like 360 sound. And like, I mean, I have like just regular like $20 Sony headphones that I'm using to play this game. And even with like these cheap headphones, right? Like I was able to still feel the full effect of hearing those voices all around, whether they do tricks with like volume or tricks with like distance and all that stuff. Like whatever magic they were able to pull off, whatever like Norse magic they were able to pull off, they did it well, because, between all the Furies voices and then, I forget which voice is like the super deep voice that like is like very like throaty and very like scary.
That's the Darkness, yeah.
The Darkness, yes. Whenever I would hear that voice come up, and like there's certain points in the game where that voice would come up a lot, it always like almost sent tingles like down my spine. It felt very weird, and that might be the ASMR effect at work.
Crinkle tinkles, baby.
Yeah, dude. It's weird. Weird, but also really cool and very effective.
They know you're weak. Get up and fight. You're pathetic.
Control the thing. Let it pass through.
Find the light. The light is your strength. Find the light. The light is your strength.
Open your eyes.
Well, I heard, like, the first boss that I went to, because you can kind of pick which one you go to, was Valravn. And, like, oh, my gosh. Yeah, like, the audio during all, because, like, the whole thing is, like, you following, like, you have to follow his song, like, when you're finding him. And, oh, it was so creepy and so good.
Oh, my God. So the gameplay of Hellblade is focused on combat and puzzles, which is like the two like main gameplay focuses. Are these elements elements of the game used to full effect? Alex, I'm throwing this one at you.
I think so. And I know like I think probably the combat is the thing that a lot of people hate the most about Hellblade, and I think there's probably a little bit too much of it. But I think the way it's integrated, how simple it is, how that there it never tells you what a single button prompt, like there's no prompts, it doesn't tell you what each button does, like it does differentiate itself enough, and I personally like the field of combat a lot, and the puzzle design is so they're like themed around the different areas that you're going to and the different kind of enemies that you're facing. I think they're all so clever, and I like that the way they lead into each other, like when you're doing these tasks to get the sword about halfway through the game. You're looking into these mirrors, and it's similar to what God of War would do a few months later. Like, there's no camera cuts. It's just kind of staring in and then pulling back out. And,
yeah.
And things are changing in the background. You can sometimes see them change. Sometimes you can't. And it's left a lot to your imagination, but like the way the puzzles work, the way that you get to them, the way it's based a lot about symbolism, and it's also based in sometimes seeing things that aren't actually there, right? Like the whole, honestly, like the mechanic of just revisiting, that you revisit throughout the game of here's a door with two symbols, find these symbols in the environment. It's very much like seeing things that aren't really there. And it's kind of playing into like darker and darker into this psychosis in Senua. So I don't know. It's all intentional in a way that works really well, I think.
Yeah, I really like this game for the fact that like it does the thing where it makes you look at the world differently. Kind of like with what you were just saying as far as like trying to match the runes to like symbolism within the world. I'm definitely not educated enough to like kind of talk about like the way that relates to the idea of psychosis. I've read and heard some things about like how those two things intermingle. I can't communicate it, but I would love for if somebody's listening, they want to write in and tell me more about that, because that stuff sounds super cool. But even just the idea from as a video game, I really like when games make you or put you in an environment and make you just kind of like chill and explore that environment to the fullest extent, because it kind of gives you the opportunity to kind of appreciate what designers did there, whether it's the level designers or the art designers. Like I really like exploratory 3D platformers, right? Stuff like Banjo, DK64, Mario 64, where you're going through the same level over and over again, but you're like kind of running around and getting to know it and getting to know that space as a very familiar space by the time you're done with it. Hellblade kind of did that similar thing, except like they turn that space into a puzzle itself and make you kind of solve it. Tom's kind of like the Witness we're talking about next week does a very similar thing. And very more like almost more actually probably in an equally intentional way. But yeah, like I just love when games do that. And it was really cool to see Hellblade do that, especially with my favorites were the puzzles where you would walk through like a door in the environment and it would change what's going on in that environment. You do that to solve the puzzle. Like those puzzles are super cool to me just because of the visual trickery going on.
And I also like that. Totally lost my train of thought.
It happens, man.
It knocked on the door and then I didn't get there in time.
That happens to me like 5 times a day where I'm like, oh yeah, and I love the part where
my quick interjection then while you're regaining that thought. A lot of Norse mythology, and this is why maybe it's cool that they chose to go this route instead of choosing, like, could you tell the story in another setting? Like, absolutely, you could choose Egyptian mythology, you could, you know what I mean? But like with Norse, there's a lot of reliance on illusion. Just like all throughout it.
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of trickery, I guess, in Norse mythology, like trickery and illusions kind of are involved in a lot of different stories. So it's cool that they chose that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Alex, did it come back, or should I move on?
It's not coming back.
I hate those ones where you're like, oh, yeah, I had a good one, and it just like
yeah, it was it good just leaves. Too. Yeah,
fuck. It's like a lost dog. Well, if it comes back, you can let me know. Until then, we're gonna get into some more game facts. So the story behind the game's release: Hellblade was announced for the PS4 at Sony's Gamescom media briefing on August 12th, 2014, where a trailer was shown. In a joint statement, Ninja Theory described the game as an experience focused on delivering a deep character in a twisted world with brutal, uncompromising combat. And stated that they wanted to make a smaller, more focused game experience that is uncompromising in its combat, art, and story. The developers called it an independent AAA game, with their goal being to make a game with all the qualities and production values of any AAA game on the market, but with the creative freedom and an indie spirit, which we talk about a lot on this podcast. Some more tidbits. The main inspiration of Senua's character was the Iseni, a lot of hard names on this podcast, this episode. Queen Boudica 619. No, with the Iseni Queen Boudica, while her name came from Senuna, a Celtic goddess long lost to historians, but rediscovered in 2002, whose name was at first read incorrectly as Senua. The team, and this is another bullet point right here, the team researching Celtic culture and the Celts' views on mental disorder found out that they use the term gelt for a man or woman who had been driven mad by a curse, grief, or the trauma of a battle, and that the gelt would take to a life in the woods in search of penance, punishment, and purgatory. The team decided to make Senua a gelt who had left her home in exile for those reasons. Also, before I read the next bullet point, shout out to everybody on podcasts who read like verbatim like articles and all that stuff like that. I understand your pain because it's very difficult to do on the fly. Senua's voice acting and motion capturing were performed by German freelance photographer and video editor Melina Jurgens, who had never done either of those things prior to Hellblade. She was used by the team as a stand-in for Senua for several months while they perfected their motion capture techniques, and they eventually came to the conclusion that she should play the character in the finalized game.
Shout out to her because she's incredible.
Shout out to her. She is like my favorite part of the game. Yeah. Have you guys seen like the behind the scenes like vlog where like she's kind of walking through like what happened in the process of like her becoming Senua?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Yeah. Like, it's really good. Like if you've played the game, listener, and you haven't watched like the different documentaries and watched that, like you should, because they're all really interesting and good.
There's one on the pause menu or start screen of Senua itself, of Hellblade, so watch it.
You are a Gaelta, a wild one, a lone wolf, a killer. But now look at you, stepping forward but moving backwards to wallow in your miserable past. You are just like your mother, losing yourself to the abyss of fear.
So let's get into the next segment. Why do we believe this game is special? So before this podcast, like every podcast, I asked the guests to write in and tell me like why they believe this game is special. I'm going to start with Alex. Alex said building a story around empathy. Alex, do you want to go deeper into what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think like we look back at the section that you just read, Bless, about how this game was initially about making a deep character, but it was more a character action game, right? And it was their follow-up after DMC, which did really well for them, for Ninja Theory, especially compared to their previous releases, which were like more cult hits. I think like you can definitely feel the shift from that to the final game of like, oh, this is something totally different about a serious thing and about a very serious story, right? Like this is not like a happy-go-lucky video game. And I don't think that's a bad thing, and I think there are very brief moments of kind of delight along the way that are like really, really pure, that are very good. And then especially like when you're so deep in it, I think you really do feel that dread that Senua does. And when she reconnects with Dillion in the story in the game about 50% of the way through, that light, you so immediately realize why it's so important to her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the whole thing, right? You are being immersed in this character. It's like they're lowering you into a pool of Senua, right? Of like her feelings and the world around her and how she feels in it, how she sees herself in it. And I think almost all of that's the audio design, which is just phenomenal top to bottom, because it is constantly pushing on you from all sides and you're mm-hmm. starting to feel that kind of cramped feeling. But from the audio design to the mechanics to what you're doing, like these puzzles of kind of looking for patterns in the world, everything like that is really trying to get you to empathize with something that probably most people will never have to experience in their life. But just being in this game for the 8 or so hours that it takes to finish it, I think it's impossible not to walk away if you really do the experience right, like with the headphones on, focused in and paying attention. I think it's impossible not to walk away with this kind of haunting sensation that you've really walked in the shoes of someone else. I don't think like any video game I've ever played has let me feel more like another person than playing Hellblade.
Yeah, I was going to echo the exact same sentiment that, like, I don't think I've ever felt more in a character's shoes than Hellblade. And that's saying something, because, like, we talked about Gone Home on this podcast in episode 2, and, like, Gone Home is a game that really, like, does a great job, phenomenal job at telling you the story of somebody who's going through something in that game. And you really feel it, and you really understand it, and you can really relate to that character because the game, like, wants you so badly to relate to that character. Whereas in Hellblade, right, like, just through the technology itself, like, through the way they actually use the technology and the way they use, like, the audio design and the way they portray the character on screen, like, every facet of this game, I feel like, is meant to put you in Senua's shoes. And that's, I don't think I've ever felt that much in that character's shoes for a game where it's a named character. Like, it's not like a nameless, like, voiceless character where it's not like Link or like Shell from Portal or somebody who is like, oh yeah, this is the avatar, you're literally this character. It's like, no, this character is a different character. They have their own story, they have their own world. In fact, this world is so foreign to you, it's not Earth, it's just like, it's the Norse realm, it's Norse mythology, it's whatever. It's Asgard, or where, no, actually it's literally Helheim, but it's a different world that you're used to, right? But you feel what she's going through to so much because of even those shots. I'll get into it later, where, because my the thing I'm bringing for what I believe makes this game special is Mulina's performance as Senua, and even the shots of her, like, struggling, or like when she looks in the camera, or like when you're face to face with Senua and you can, like, see in her face, like, what she is going through.
Yes.
Like I've never, like, felt something like that in a game. I've never felt a character's struggle.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you bring this up, because, like, this is something that, and this is going to be me pulling out my woman's soapbox and standing on this for a second, because I got to shout out to this game. Like, there are so many games, and, like, we're seeing more and more games with female protagonists, of course. But, like, even someone like Lara Croft, every time that she does something, like, even if she's, like, falling 30 feet off a cliff, you have to do it beautifully. You know what I mean? It's she's still looking, like, ridiculously hot and wearing a tank top. Even if it's not the busty Lara Croft we used to know, like, she's still looking good. And, like, Melina Jurgens, like, don't get me wrong, absolutely beautiful girl, but it's like, when she acts, it's raw.
Yeah.
Like, she's not doing it in a way that's like, oh, and also I look really attractive while I'm, like, screaming in agony. It's like emotion, just pure straightforward emotion, and you don't get that a lot.
Yeah.
Like, and female characters, it's usually, like, kind of male gazy, as far as, like, you know, you need to do this and also still be, like, someone that you know, the male character will want to sleep with, or someone that guys will find attractive. Like, it's just, like, raw acting and energy and emotion.
Yeah.
And she delivers it so powerfully, and, like, that just shows you, like, how incredible these games can be when you allow like, women characters to have that freedom,
like,
and women actors to have that, like, you know, to deliver that.
Yeah. Like, there are parts where she's just straight up, like, screaming at the camera, like out of, like, just pain and suffering, is just, like, screaming. Mm-hmm. And I felt every, like, inch of that. Like,
yeah.
it's crazy how well they're able to put together this performance, especially for somebody who's this is their first acting gig.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like, it's like even when she gets off the boat in the very beginning, yes, like she's like, is she gonna kick the boat back into the river and do this and go to Helheim and do this? And like just her face, like her wide eyes as she's like processing what she's going to do, as she's hearing the voices, as she's considering things, like, you know, the mouth kind of open. Like it's not like a it's very powerful, and it's very it seems like you're watching something that you shouldn't be looking at.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. And this is like my favorite scene in this game is the one where it's after you fight like the first two bosses, mm-hmm. like the sun god or the fire god and the illusion guy, mm-hmm. like I forget it, Surt and the other one.
Surt and Valravn.
Valravn, yeah. After that, and you kind of go through the whole cutscene of I think it's a vision. I wasn't sure exactly what it is, but
when she crosses a bridge and gets attacked.
It was before she crosses the bridge.
Okay.
Where it's essentially like she's I think it's a vision of her like going to the village and like finding Dillian's head. I think that's what
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
But like there's like a shot. And this is like one of those like the Twitter account One Perfect Shot could probably like post this one right here, where she's just staring into the camera and it's dark. It's like black all behind her, and it's just like her, and it's her staring to the camera, and the camera slowly panning out from a close-up shot of her face, and just her giving like the most like mean, like just the meanest glare I've ever seen in my life. I've never felt something like that. I screenshot, and I kept screenshotting because I was like, this shot is perfect, and I just want to like make this shot my wallpaper on everything, because like she looks like she's about to kick some ass for real. And even I was scared of her. I was like, yo, I might need to like, you know, like turn down the brightness of the screen a little bit, because like she's coming at this super hard.
And
the composition in that game is phenomenal.
Great. It's so like the scene where you walk up for the first time, you see like the whole like the horse shaped like head of like the big old structure across the bridge. Like, God, super good. And like, not to mention like her performance is that good in a game where she's like basically the only character. Yeah. Like there are other characters, but they're not necessarily like physically there. Like they're all either in her mind or through visions. But like there's like enemies and stuff. But like, it's not really, she doesn't have like a whatchamacallit, like a side character or like mm-hmm. I don't know, like it's not a cast of characters. It's her like on this journey alone, and she's able to perform through talking to herself essentially, and talking to the voices in her head, and able to perform that well and that solidly. Shout out to her. She definitely deserves the awards she got that year for her performances as Melina.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's telling that they're trying to convey, like, the thing they want the player to get out of this more than anything is, like, the feelings of someone else, right? When a lot of the most impactful scenes of this game are you just staring into her eyes face to face and just watching how she is reacting to what she's hearing. And that's it. Like, it's typically a completely blacked out background. It's just cinema. It's her talking to the darkness, or her talking to Dillian, or like the memories of her mother, or Druth. Like, it's just one on one, you staring her in the eyes and watching her feelings, and like that feeling just being a mirror reflected back into the player. It's really, really intimate. Is another part of it. It's not trying to tap into like broad feelings, like joy or sadness, even though it does touch on them. It's going for these very nuanced and specific feelings of what would it feel like to hate yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what, how much can we try and put that feeling in the player without it being necessarily too toxic? And then how can we start to pull that out and turn that around into something positive of kind of self-belief and empowerment, right? And it's that arc of that you feel as you go through the game. It's not just something that you're watching and seeing. You're feeling it with Senua, of her kind of turning her greatest weaknesses into her greatest strengths, is unlike anything else ever. Not just in video games, but like in movies, in anything. It's unbelievable. And I think there's so much thought and care into it. And like, especially going through the beginning again, you see like, these were doctors that were involved on this. These were people that like we wanted to make sure that we did this right. We talked to a lot of people and we thought about this a lot. And it's so earnest, it's so intimate, and it's so genuine. I think it works.
in those ultimate ultimate opening credits are, I don't know what an ultimate credit is, those opening credits are very telling, where she's like rowing on the boat. One, they're like very stylized, they're really cool, but when she's like rowing on the boat towards Helheim and you see the credits pop up, like just like as figments in the water, like I think one of the first ones was like mental health consultant or something like that, something along those lines. And they really wanted to set that foot forward and be like, hey, like, just so you know, like, we're going in this game, like we're doing the thing, like we're doing research and we're trying to portray this character in a way that is going to do it justice.
Jessica,
your element was the love story. Talk about that a bit.
Okay, so I brought it up a little bit earlier in this podcast as far as, to me, at its core, this game is a love story. This game, you know, for being rooted in Norse mythology, this game plays like it could have been a myth from back then. Mm-hmm. You know, telling the story of a woman essentially willing to sell her soul or to go through these trials to bring back the love of her life. And it's interesting that this game, which is a love story, was told through, I guess, the vessel of it being an action game, which, like I said, that's kind of an unusual thing, you know. And I guess, yeah, I mean, you could look at it and not think it's entirely a romance game, but in my opinion, I think it very much relies on that. Mm-hmm. And it is. But I think that's interesting. And I guess, like, oh, this game made me cry. This game made me cry like a baby.
Yeah,
and it was really because of the love story of it all. Because all it takes, especially, you know, I'm somebody, I have bipolar disorder. And to find the people in your life, because it doesn't always have to be just one person, but the people in your life who can kind of help you review your trauma and help you come to the conclusion, like, hey, you know, maybe it's not that you're fucked up, maybe it's like just the world is a little bit sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. And like, and her kind of meeting Dillian and like this person who comes into her life and like it's like, hey, you know, your mother was killed in front of you, that's horrible and messed up, and your father convinced you you were a monster your whole entire life because you were just a little bit different, while also like in doing that perpetuated that and created this and made it worse of a problem. Like, I want to take care of you, I want to get you out of this, I want you to live the life that you deserve and to feel human because you've never been made to feel human before. And just like to have that come into your life and then to go through the pain of losing that person, and, you know, to kind of go off of Alex's point about how like the game makes you, it relies on empathy. It makes you have to be empathetic to really feel the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already just a deeply empathetic person. So for me, I was like, I get this. Yeah. Like, I get why she's doing this. I get the motivations. I feel this. Like, if you had that one, like, ray of light, that sunshine in other words, or in what is otherwise just a really horrible existence, like, mm-hmm. wouldn't you do anything to get that back?
Yeah,
you know. So it's so powerful the way that's delivered, and just like it's tragic. You feel for her, you feel their love was true. And it's not like in so many love stories where like it's not like a complicated thing, it's not, you know, you never see their fights, you never see their struggles, you don't see the messiness of the relationship, that's not the focus, but you just see like this one really good person who really loved her and really just wanted her to be happy and wanted the best for her. And that's, you know, all we can ask for, I think, in partners and friends, and the people that we love, is for them to kind of come to us with that acceptance and to make us feel that way. It's just, it's a beautiful story. It's really beautiful. Horribly sad, but beautiful.
I like also just like building on that is how it is like a post-mortem love story too, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're reliving these memories and there's no like damsels, there's no people in distress, there's no kind of like, honestly, to some extent, there's no hope really, but it is like really setting up this important lesson that it kind of gets to by the end of like, just because someone positive in your life is no longer there doesn't mean that the effect that they had on you wasn't real, and
yes.
and the presence that they have in you still as a person, like, a part of you is not any less real either, because a big part of Senua is like the voices in her head take on the voices of these people in her life over time, right? Mm-hmm. We learn that the darkness, one of the voices is this representation of her father, but we also have this light that's a representation of Dillian and her mother. And Druth obviously is this recounting voice, still talking to her, or just rehashing the things and the stories that he told her before. This all this love that isn't permanent by any means, but like has stuck with her and created a love within her for herself, is like really powerful. And it is like not enough stories deal with the fallout of loss. And I think this game is all about that. And like coming to the realization that the positive effect someone has on you doesn't ever have to go away, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that you added all that, because it is. It's a story about love and loss and the idea of like loving after loss, and how we carry on. Dillian at the very end is what essentially, you know, he kind of prepares her to deal with loss. Mm-hmm. I'm getting emotional. It's such a good game.
It is.
But it's really good. You know, he's the one who kind of prepares her for that. And it's his advice from beyond the grave that ends up making her okay in the end. Or at least, like, you know, we feel hopeful that she can move on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She can stand up at least with the hopes of moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually for the segment, I ask for people's elements beforehand. And the main reason for that is so that there's like no overlap. Cause usually like for Cuphead, people will be like, oh, the animation, right? Or like Celeste, people will say the music, right? This game is probably the first one, I think, in the series where like going in, like nobody had any overlap. Like even me, the one I had in my head, I'll let other people go first. Actually, depending on how it goes, I'll either like present mine first. There was no overlap. And I think that's because like there are just so many elements of this game that work so well, and they all just work together. Like the love story works together with the technology, which works together, like with the mental health stuff that they're tackling in this game, that works together with the mythology. Like it all just like they're all just holding hands. Like all these elements are just holding hands in order to like feed the central kind of theme and plot of this game.
Greater than the sum of its parts, for sure. Yeah, and the sum of its parts are all very good.
Yeah.
Perhaps this is the darkness tricking her, but it could be her mother trying to break through. She must find out.
So let's get into the last segment, which is categories. So each episode, I'll ask the same questions about all these games to kind of figure out, like, okay, how do these games kind of compare to each other in these categories? And so the first category is the indie factor. Does this game capture the spirit of the indie game dev, or of indie game development in general? Yeah. Which was kind of tackled a little bit before in Game Facts, but Alex, I'll let you give me your answer first.
Yeah, I think it does, because, right, you look at, and I know this is the third time we're comparing it to it, and I do kind of feel bad, but like you look at God of War, which is a Norse story tackling Norse mythology. I think it is like more deeply rooted in exactly that subject. Whereas the approach that Hellblade took was a way, way more intimate approach. And I think that intimacy is exactly what makes it indie. Like small teams make small stories, I think is like a running theme in some of my favorite indie games, like Gone Home that you mentioned earlier. And this is a really, really small story about one person's trials to save another. And I think that encompasses why this is indie. Like you can look at the graphics, the fidelity, and the kind of incredible technology that's been put into this game. But when you play it, when you feel it, and when you follow the story that it's telling, you really are like, this is different. Like it's not in the same mentality of a AAA game. It is not about big particle effects, graphics, explosions, and murder. It is about something totally different, and that is exactly the indie factor, I feel. Mm.
Jess, what say you?
I completely agree. I think that this game it's something to where, like, you might not even think about it, but it's like, it's so incredibly niche. Like, it is a woman protagonist. It is about mental health. It has love in it, which is not something that's in, like, you know, it's weird because, like, love is something that's, like, kind of associated with being, like, a woman genre when, you know, like, every human loves, so it's kind of a weird thing, but like it has love in it, which is kind of more niche in games and stuff like that. It has Norse mythology, which is weird. It's historical, which is like kind of weird. It has all of these elements that are like kind of strange and you don't see in every game, especially in like a lot of AAA games. Just even the composition of it is kind of different. The way just the acting is different. Like, mm-hmm. there's just so many things about this game that are kind of weird. But, like, it all works and creates something that's incredibly powerful. And I'm so happy that it ended up getting the critical reception that it did.
Yeah.
And, like, what Alex said, I really love the whole idea of, like, you know, small companies, small stories, because that's very much what this is. It's very intimate. It's an experience that is unlike what you'd get anywhere else.
Yeah. I really like that they called it independent AAA because like the production value like is definitely there as far as visuals and audio and kind of, I was gonna say scope, but I guess like the world isn't huge, but like it kind of gives that feeling of the world being huge, if that makes sense. Like you look into the distance and you the see the structure and you're like, wow,
you know.
Yeah. But even despite that, like, it's still the I mean, the way they described it, too, is that the story and narrative, all that stuff were meant to be uncompromising. And I think you feel that as you're playing the game, like the story feels very much like its own story. And yeah, no, shout out to Hellblade, because I think, I would say, too, that it definitely encompasses that same spirit. The next category is what I call successful successor. Can this game get a sequel that lives up to it?
No.
It's a difficult question.
I hope not.
No.
Not everything needs to be a franchise. Not everything needs sequels. I think that like something that was really appealing about Hellblade was it was half the price of a normal game and was only going to be what, like an 8-9 hour game like to play through. And like sometimes that's just like fine. That's actually like it's a bit of a relief. Like not every game has to have 40 hours of content for it to be worth it, you know what I mean? Like I that's something that like just growing older I found that I like more too. Like I tend to enjoy I don't know, movies that are like a little bit shorter tend to have like be a little bit more powerful sometimes, or like short stories I really love, or just shorter like one-off, like I really like things that are just one and done, because I think that those can pack the most powerful punch. You know, sometimes we get too wrapped up in like cinematic universes and like, you know, these like long spanning franchises that just spin off and off and off, and so it's like nice to just have like a one and done solid deal. And like I hope it doesn't get one. I would love for them to do things like it, and to maybe like do like, especially like with mythology, I think mythology is cool, or even just different like maybe parts of history that aren't really explored that much, because I think they did that really well and they told a really human story very well. So like keep doing that, that's super cool, but maybe let Senua kind of just be is my thought.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I even want like another game in the same like world. I want more Norse games, of course, but like not in this like same like Hellblade's Newest Sacrifice world. Cause like I mean, they can re-release the game as many times as they want. I think that'd be dope if like for the next PS5 and Xbox 2, like if there's a Hellblade there remastered or whatever, like go for it, I'm down for that. But this is what, like this I think in like Gone Home might be the only game so far, there might be another game where the answer is very much, for me at least, a very strict no. I don't necessarily want, or I can really even see a sequel. Like first, I don't know what they would do in a sequel, and even if they need a prequel, I don't think I'd want a prequel. I don't think I really care too much about what Senua and Dillion and all of them were up to outside of what was told in this story, because I feel like the story they told in this game was effective enough for me to understand that relationship and get and fill in the blanks myself. So yeah,
exactly. Like that's what I was gonna say, is like the game gives us enough context to where like And it's not like an overabundance of the details in the context. Like it gives you enough to where it's like, you're like, oh, hey, like I've felt that. Like I have that person who was that in my life, or like I had people who made me feel this way. Like, and so you can kind of fill in like those emotions and process that and understand like how she feels now, I think. You know, you don't need all the nitty gritty.
I feel like you're forgetting the blessing that this is the spiritual successor to Heavenly Sword.
That's true. Hellblade, Heavenly Sword. Are they in the same universe? Because I never played Heavenly Sword.
No, they did talk about it being a spiritual successor to Heavenly Sword, though. I don't know in what way they had that in mind, but...
Yeah, it's a weird thing, because, like, title-wise, I could very well see it. It makes a lot of sense.
It's very intentional.
I don't know if, like, if after playing the game, you're like, oh, snap, Sanu was obviously this person's sister. Like,
yeah, maybe there's anything just like
weird like that.
Easter eggs or something. But yeah, I think like a mechanical sequel to Hellblade would be really interesting. Take what you learned here. Take this concept of trying to tackle this mental illness and psychosis and these things that are hard for the general person to empathize with, and try and tell another story, not necessarily like this, but with these same tools. I think that is something worth pursuing in of itself. And I wonder, like, one of the things Microsoft highlighted when they said they bought Ninja Theory was how great Hellblade was and how unique it was. So I wonder if they tasked them with doing something like that. I don't know. Like, we can hope. I'd love to see more games like this. That's for sure.
So the next category is play of the game. What is this game's most important moment? So I have three options, and if you don't like any of my options, you can write in your own option. And here's the thing, guys. I'm very bad at this specific category, is what I've learned by this episode. Because it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, man, what happened in the game? And even during my research, I'm like, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I feel like this category specifically would require me to replay the whole game to really get some good ones. But this is what I got. First one is Senua's vision of Dillian's death after she defeats the fire giant Surt in the Spirit of Illusions Valravn, which I actually referenced kind of earlier in the show. The second option is Senua's facing the four challenges at the Great Tree, revealing her backstory. And the last one, Senua freeing herself from the darkness's influence and accepting the Furies, not only or not as a curse, but as a part of who she is. Jessica, what say you?
Gosh, it's so hard to narrow it down to just one. Come back to me. Make Alex do it first.
Alex, what say you?
He's a veteran. He's been doing this longer.
I would say that my personal favorite would probably be like the very end, which I think is the last point you have here, where it's kind of like that self-acceptance, that empowerment moment. But I'm hesitant to say that because I will be honest, like, it was very unclear at that exact moment what was happening.
Yeah.
I think that's like the least clear part of it. I like how obtuse it is for the most part, save for that one moment, which I found was powerful but a little confusing. It's not on here, but one of the moments that I like, I don't know how important it is, but for me as the player in the narrative, it was really important, was, and it was certainly one of my favorite sequences in the whole game, was when you're walking through like the undergrounds, and there are monsters that you can't see, that they're invisible monsters walking around, and Dillian is guiding you with his light. And it's like this very quiet and horrifying sequence, and it's like there's not a lot of horror moments in this game. There's certainly a lot of alarming ones, but this is the only real horror one. But the thing that was really powerful about it was like this: you immediately establish the relationship between Senua and Dillian through this kind of very physical metaphor of him being literally the light of her life, and you really get a sense for the way he talks to her and builds her up and says things to instill confidence in her of like what that relationship is and how important that was for her. I think that was like personally like really important for me along that journey, because it really just beats you to the ground before then. And then you finally get this positive beacon of light, this force of light in Senua. And I, that was the moment where I really empathized with them. Like, man, this is like a whole other level right here.
Was that one of like the Great Tree trials, or is that
I think it is one of the trials.
Okay, gotcha. I love those trials. There's one specifically amazing. There's one specifically where I was like, this is incredible, and I can't remember what it was exactly. I just remember the moment being like, oh, this is incredible.
Yeah, there are a couple of those. I feel like there are two that are like really, really incredible, but
yeah, like some very good storytelling moments in those. I really need to replay the game. I started to replay it and I thought I was gonna be able to get through it all before doing the podcast, and then video games just came out.
Yeah. Hella yeah. games. Yeah. Hella no, it's games. It is one of Helheim the trials games. Helheim games. it is one of the trials, I think, and like all those trials are really good with like the relationship with Dillion, but yeah, that was the one that stuck out the most.
Jess, have you figured it out?
I have, because you know, Alex talking about it made me kind of think about the parts, like, and I'd have to go with the trials too, like the four mm-hmm. challenges, because like that was when I broke down. Because yeah. like, I think like when you see Dillion's death, it's very shocking and brutal, but it doesn't really hit you yet, because you're not seeing like the man who he was and what he represented. But when you are going through the trials and you start to see that, and you start to like feel what their relationship was and what he meant to her and like what he still means to her, like mm-hmm. that's when it starts to really get you. So I would go with that as well.
Awesome. Yeah, and even the last I'll especially you guys to go with like that last one, because the Celeste episode we recorded has like a very similar moment. Yeah. And I feel like that's the one people usually gravitate to. But yeah, the four trials I feel like were just such a strong I remember having such a strong emotional reaction.
Yeah.
To those trials, because the way they're kind of individualized, and they're kind of like these smaller moments within like this bigger challenge, I guess. But the each of those ones I remember being like poignant in what they were trying to convey. And I remember getting that and being like, yo, that was wild.
It's like the other one, the third that I was thinking about is like the whole sequence with the dog beast Garm is like, I think, really incredible. But like, I think part of why the trials stick out for all of us is like, you know, you open the gate, you go across the bridge, Hela appears as a giant form and beats you, breaks your sword, beats you down. Mm-hmm. You almost die, right? It is like, and the darkness is telling you how much of a failure you are. It is like the very beginning of like you're at rock bottom and you're building yourself back up to self-empowerment. Like it's telling that I think all the beats along that way to self-empowerment are really, really good and really strong.
The last category we have here is masterpiece doesn't mean perfect. If you could change one thing about this game, what would it be?
Probably less fighting. I would.
That's exactly what I was gonna say too.
I would probably put less combat in almost every video game I play now, though.
Oh yeah, so I feel
like,
that.
Yeah.
The thing with Hellblade is it's like the combat. Okay, so like I think this game is fantastic and perfect and great, but the combat is not interesting enough to be as like as much as it is in the game. Mm-hmm. So it's like you either needed to have less combat and keep it like the way it is, because like it's not bad, it's just not super interesting. Like you don't get new skills, you don't build, you know, there's no like RPG like elements to it.
The way they make it more difficult is by throwing more enemies at you at once.
Yes. Yeah. it's just more enemies and like some that can guard a little better type stuff. Mm-hmm. Like it's so, but it's not interesting enough to like merit how much it's used. So it's like either scale it back and keep it simple, but like just focus on the story, because like this is a story game. It's not like, and it's kind of funny when you're talking up there about how like they said they wanted unrelenting combat. Like the combat in the game's not really that hard. Like I didn't really struggle with it, and like I'm not like the world's greatest video game player, so like I'm not saying this, and like I didn't struggle. Like I still suck ass at like every Souls game, but you know, like I don't know. They kind of needed to go one way or the other with it. Like, just admit the fact that this is a story-based game and cut back some of the combat and keep it simple, or make the combat engaging enough to where, like, yes, you're also doing that super fucking well.
Hmm. Yeah.
I agree. The combat was the thing that kind of was holding me back as far as, like, even especially, like, during Game of the Year discussions, I was just like, yeah, man, the game's amazing. It's incredible. It does have a lot of fighting. That's a lot of the same, mm-hmm. but the game is incredible. I think I agree with you guys there. I don't know. I don't even know what else though. I would change if I could change anything. I think. I would even say like maybe if the game could control better, but like it's good enough. Like yes, like a lot of stuff in the game gets the job done. Like once again, just it's a game made by a small team. Like mm-hmm. I can't like expect it to be like God of War or be like. I don't like super polished AAA gameplay experience. Like, but what is there and what they do with what is there, is incredible. It's almost like an artist that like makes like just an incredible piece from like, a paint, palette of like limited colors. Mm-hmm. It's great. And that brings us to the end of a great podcast, guys.
We did it. Hour 12.
A great podcast about a great game.
We did it. We did the thing. Of course, these guys are on Twitter. Alex on Twitter at ALFighter27.
Yeah, you nailed it, dude.
I did that off the top of my head. I was like scrolling up the dock. I was like, I'm not going to get there in time. and then Jessica is on Twitter at Jessa Cogs. That is JESSACOGS. Check out Irrational Passions. That's where both Jessica and Alex are from. They put out some great content over there. They got the Irrational Passions podcast. They got articles. They got videos going up on the Irrational Passions YouTube channel. Is there anything I'm missing, Alex? Is there anything you want to plug?
We did a very great post-PAX video that Mike Burgess edited that is like a little documentary style, like how Irrational Passions does PAX. It's great because it has all 8 of us in it. And it's fun and it's intimate, and there's a fun little like after the credits blooper reel that is a jolly good time.
Do that. Of course, go to rationalpassions.com. Just check out. Just scroll.
Yeah, you got stuff to look at. It's
you got things there.
Read a Jared Green article and enrich your day. Do yourself a favor.
Do yourself a favor. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Blessing Jr. OKBeast is on Twitter at OKBeast. Now, I don't do a lot of plugging of OKBeast on the show, which is weird because this is an OKBeast podcast. You should check out the OKBeast podcast, though, which comes out every single Monday on OKBeast.com and your podcast service of choice. Remember, Indie Peace, we have 2 more episodes left after this. It's an 8-episode series. We're almost there, guys.
Also, you should support OKBeast on Patreon because they put out good work and are a bunch of good boys who deserve your hard-earned dollars if you have them to give.
Yes. Exactly what she said. Follow what Jessica said. Do that. Patreon.com/OKBeast. And until next episode, Indie Peace out. I still haven't figured that out.
That's a cute little outro.